Lock Talk Radio.
Oh, okay. So it's going to be at Cook County Jail.
Women have the power to transform this world. We can end crime and violence if we all agree to do one thing. Share. Let's share our wisdom, share our time, share our talent, share our finances. But most of all, let's share our love. This is the Female Solution. Join me, Naima Latif, every morning, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, as we bring you stimulating discussions about the issues affecting our lives. If you're listening online at www.blogtalkradio.com/the-female-solution, press the blue button that says follow and get our daily topics every morning directly to your email and your smartphone.
Hi, I'm Naima Latif, executive producer of the Female Solution Radio Show. We invite you to call in 515-605-9325 and participate in this daily think tank as we examine the challenges we face and develop solutions that restore peace and harmony. We are global transformers, changing the world from the way it is to the way it should be. We are one. Wherever we live on this earth, we are one human family. On behalf of our team of radio hosts, I'd like to extend a greeting to all the members of our family, whenever and wherever you may be listening around the world. To our family in China, Ni Hao. In India, Namaste. In Japan, Konnichiwa. In Korea, Annyeonghaseyo. In Russia, Zdrastuytse. In Germany, Guten Tag. In Poland, Dzień dobry. In France, Bonjour. In Spain, Hola. In Italy, Ciao. In Egypt, Ahlan wa sahlan. In Ghana, Akwaaba. In Nigeria, Peleo. In South Africa, Saubona. In Senegal, Nangadef. In Kenya, Jambo. In Israel, Shalom. In Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia, Assalamu alaikum. Greetings, and may peace be upon you all.
Welcome everyone to Soul Purpose Healing. I am feeling so relaxed because I spent the morning at the beach, and it was a little draining, but just relaxing and exhausting in some way. And then I drove back home, and so I'm just really grateful for the day that I've had today on the beach, watching this amazing sunrise. In fact, I'm going to be posting a video on my YouTube channel, Viata's Tiny House Village, and it will be called Sex on the Beach, because it was just me and the sun. I'm not even in the video, but it's just all sun and energy. So it'll be a spiritual exchange, energy exchange on the beach. That's what it'll be titled. So watch for that on my YouTube channel, Viata's Tiny House Village. And that's going to be a vacation from the village at the beach. Woo! it was just so exciting to be at the beach to see that amazing sunrise. But tonight, we have to talk about, we need to talk about, we should talk about emotional intelligence again. Every time I try and go to another subject, Spirit just has been drawing me back to this title, this topic of emotional intelligence. Why? Because we need to talk about it. There's audio. If you missed it, I'm going to play an audio that I played last week and on Friday. Why do we need to develop emotional intelligence? Here we go.
Emotional intelligence refers to the ability to recognize, interpret, and process emotions in yourself and others. While genetics, upbringing, and environment all play a role, there are steps you can take to develop your emotional intelligence over time. Get to know yourself. Emotionally intelligent people are self-aware. They have a realistic appreciation of their strengths and weaknesses and how they come across to others. Peer feedback is one way of improving your self-awareness and may uncover a few of your emotional blind spots. Learn your triggers. Linked to the notion of self-awareness is knowing how you are likely to respond in particular situations. Think about how you felt the last time you were under pressure. Did these feelings help or hinder you? Recognizing emotions and the source of these emotions can shift your emotional state. Empathize. Seeing things from someone else's perspective will help you understand their values and beliefs. This is important when it comes to motivating and engaging others. Make a conscious effort to get to know your colleagues. Ask open questions and actively listen to what they have to say, rather than simply waiting for your turn to speak. Be on the lookout for body language and other nonverbal signs, as these may tell you more than someone is willing to express out loud. Own your emotions. Part of being emotionally intelligent is about taking responsibility for the way you interact with others. If someone upsets you, pause and reflect on why their actions led you to feel this way, instead of reacting impulsively. Recognize that a conversation is a two-way interaction, and it takes two people to make you angry, sad, or frustrated. Go with your gut. Finally, listen to your body. If your stomach starts doing backflips every time you speak to a senior manager, or your muscles tense up before you go into a meeting, what does this tell you? Counterintuitive as it might seem, emotions can be a valuable source of information when making rational decisions at work. Remember, emotional intelligence isn't about suppressing emotions. It's about learning how to recognize, process, and channel them in a way that benefits you and your team. Enhancing your emotional intelligence requires effort, but it can be achieved with sustained practice.
So we're talking about emotional intelligence for the third time. This is part three. Partly because this week marks my mother, my birth mother's birthday on the 24th. And the one thing about my mother that was very challenging was her addiction to alcohol. From the time I was a very, very young child, I remember her having an addiction to alcohol. And it was very sad for me most of my life to observe and witness this behavior. So I thought this today is a good topic because alcohol is damaging families, relationships. Those who choose to use alcohol to suppress emotions, manage emotions, and just to comfort themselves, usually find themselves addicted to it if they don't get to the root of the problem. So we're going to listen to the experts tonight. I have an opinion. I have a belief. But I want to bring in Dr. Gabor Maté. He is the expert on addiction. And he brings some enlightening, very important, valuable knowledge information about why people become addicted. And this is the key to developing emotional intelligence, because when you learn why people become addicted from the expert, Dr. Gabor Maté, then you will begin to understand why they sometimes can't be fixed. If they're not willing to go within and really look at what has been going on in their life and why they have chosen alcohol or drugs or whatever, and they are now addicted to it, using that substance regularly to soothe the pain. So let's listen to the expert, Dr. Gabor Maté, The Power of Addiction. And I actually have a video that I want to play for of him from YouTube. So I'm going to play this video. Let me see how it works. And you can actually hear and see him, hopefully no echoes or vibrations. But I want to bring him in about the power of addiction and the addiction of power.
I've come to talk to you about addiction, the power of addiction, but also addiction to power. As a medical doctor, I work in Vancouver, Canada, and I've worked with some very, very addicted people, people who use heroin, they inject cocaine, they drink alcohol, crystal meth, and every drug known to man. And these people suffer. If the success of a doctor is to be measured by how long his patients live, then I'm a failure, because my patients die very young, relatively speaking. They die of HIV, they die of hepatitis C, they die of infections of their heart valves, they die of infections of their brain, of their spine, of their hearts, of their bloodstream. They die of suicide, of overdose, of violence, of accidental deaths. And if you look at them, you call to mind the words of the great Egyptian novelist Naguib Mahfouz, who wrote, "Nothing records the effects of a sad life as graphically as the human body," because these people lose everything. They lose their health, they lose their beauty, they lose their teeth, they lose their wealth, they lose human relationship, and in the end, they often lose their lives. And yet nothing shakes them from their addiction. Nothing can force them to give up their addiction. The addictions are powerful. And the question is why? And as one of my patients said to me, "I'm not afraid of dying," he said, "I'm more afraid of living." And the question we have to ask is, why are people afraid of life? And if you want to understand addiction, you can't look at what's wrong with the addiction. You have to look at what's right about it. In other words, what is the person getting from the addiction? What are they getting that otherwise they don't have? And what addicts get are relief from us, from pain, but they get a sense of peace, a sense of control, a sense of calmness, very, very temporary. And the question is, why are these qualities missing from their lives? What happened to them? Now, if you look at the drugs like heroin, like morphine, like codeine, if you look at cocaine, if you look at alcohol, these are all painkillers, one way or another, soothe pain. And that's what the real question in addiction is, not why the addiction, but why the pain. Now, I just finished reading the biography of Keith Richards, the guitarist for the Rolling Stones. And as you probably know, everybody's still surprised that Richards is still alive today, because he was a heavy-duty heroin addict for a long time. And in his biography, he writes that the addiction was all about looking for oblivion, looking for forgetting. He said the contortions that we go through just not to be ourselves for a few hours. And I understand that very well myself, because I know that discomfort with myself. I know that discomfort being in my own skin. I know that desire to escape from my own mind, the great British psychiatrist R.D. Lang said that there are three things that people are afraid of death, of other people, and their own mind. And for a long time in my life, I wanted to distract myself from my own mind because I was afraid to be alone with it. And how would I distract myself? Well, I've never used drugs, but I've distracted myself through work and throwing myself into activity. And I've distracted myself through shopping. In my case, for classical compact music. But I've been a real addict that way. 1 week I spent $8,000 on the classical compact disc, not because I wanted to, but because I couldn't help going back to the store. And as a medical doctor, I used to deliver a lot of babies. And once I left a woman in labor in a hospital to get a classical piece of music. And I still could have made it back to the store, to the hospital on time. But once you're in the store, you can't leave because there's evil classical music dealers in the aisles, you know. Hey, buddy, have you listened to the latest Mozart symphony cycle? You haven't? Well, so I missed the delivery of that baby. And I'd come home and I'd lie to my wife about it like an addict. I would lie about it. And I would ignore my own children because of my obsession with work and with music. So I know what that escape from the self is like. And my definition of addiction is any behavior that gives you temporary relief, temporary pleasure, but in the long term causes harm, has some negative consequences, and you can't give it up despite those negative consequences. And from that perspective, you can understand that there's many, many addictions. Yes, there's the addiction to drugs, but also the addiction to consumerism. There's the addiction to sex, to the internet, to shopping, to food. The Buddhists have this idea of the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts are creatures with large empty bellies and small, scrawny necks and tiny little mouths, so they can never get enough. They can never feel this emptiness on the inside. And we all hungry ghosts in this society. We all have this emptiness. So many of us are trying to fill that emptiness from the outside. And the addiction is all about trying to fill that emptiness from the outside. Now, if you want to ask the question of why people are in pain, you can't look at their genetics. You have to look at their lives. And in the case of my patients, my highly addicted patients, it's very clear why they're in pain, because they've been abused all their lives. They began life as abused children. All the women I worked with over a 12-year period, hundreds of them, they had all been sexually abused as children. And the men had been traumatized as well. The men had been sexually abused, neglected, physically abused, abandoned, and emotionally hurt over and over again. And that's why the pain. And there's something else here too. The human brain. The human brain itself, as you heard already, develops an interaction with the environment. It's not just genetically programmed. The kind of environment that a child has will actually shape the development of the brain. Now, I can tell you about two experiences with mice. You take a little mouse and you put food in his mouth, and he'll eat it and enjoy it and swallow it. But if you put the food down a few inches away from his nose, he will not move to eat it. He will actually starve to death rather than eat. Why? Because genetically, they knocked out the receptors for a chemical in the brain called dopamine. Dopamine is the incentive motivation chemical. Dopamine flows whenever we're motivated, excited, vital, vibrant, curious about something, when we're seeking food or a sexual partner. Without the dopamine, we have no motivation. Now, what do you think the addict gets? When the addict shoots cocaine, the addict shoots crystal meth, or almost any drug, they get a hit of dopamine in their brain. And the question is, what happened to their brains in the first place? Because it's a myth that drugs are addictive. Drugs are not by themselves addictive, because most people who try most drugs never become addicted. So the question is, why are some people vulnerable to be addicted? Just like food is not addictive, it is. Shopping is not addictive, but to some people it is. Television is not addictive, but to some people it is. So the question is, why is it? There's another little experiment with mice where infant mice, if they're separated from the mothers, will not cry for their mothers. Now, what would that mean in the wild? It means that they would die, because only the mother protects the child's life and nurtures the child. And why? Because genetically, they knocked out the receptors, the chemical binding sites in the brain for endorphins. And endorphins are our indigenous morphine-like substances. Endorphins are our own natural painkillers. And what morphine also do, they make possible the experience of love. They make possible the experience of attachment to the parent and the parent's attachment to the child. So these little mice without endorphin receptors in their brains will actually not call for their mothers. In other words, the addiction to these drugs and, of course, the heroin and the morphine, what they do is they act on the endorphin system. That's why they work. And so the question is, what happens to people that they need these chemicals from the outside? Well, what happens to them is when they're abused as children, those circuits don't develop. When you don't have love and connection in your life, when you're very, very young, then those important brain circuits just don't develop properly. And under conditions of abuse, things just don't develop properly, and their brains then are susceptible when they do the drugs. Now they feel normal. Now they feel pain relief. Now they feel love. And there's one patient said to me that when I first did heroin, she said, it felt like a warm, soft hug, just like a mother hugging a baby. Now, I've had that same emptiness, not to the same degree as my patients. What happened to me? What happened to me is that I was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1944 to Jewish parents, just before the Germans occupied Hungary. And you know what happened to the Jewish people in Eastern Europe. And I was 2 months old when the German army moved into Budapest, the Wehrmacht, and the day after they did, my mother phoned the pediatrician and she said, would you please come and see Gabor, because he's crying all the time. And the pediatrician said, of course I will come to see him, but I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying. Now why? What do babies know about Hitler or genocide or war? Nothing. What we're picking up on is the stresses and the terrors and the depression of our mothers. And that actually shapes the child's brain. That actually shapes the child's brain. And, of course, what happens then is I get the message that the world doesn't want me. Because if my mother's not happy around me, she must not want me.
We have just heard from Dr. Gabor Maté, who is, in my opinion, an expert on addictions. And we're talking about alcohol. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about alcohol because this week marks my mother's. She would have been 95 years old. But my mother passed away at the age of 66 from basically alcohol addiction. So I have a real sensitivity to people in my life, or I've had a very sensitive feelings about people who are abusing alcohol, drinking alcohol excessively, and I've become more and more aware of my own emotional intelligence to recognize when I'm triggered with sadness because of people's alcohol abuse, remembering my own mother. And how I was ignored most of my childhood in terms of nurturing and caring because my mother was addicted to a substance that she used, as Dr. Gabor said, heal the pain, soothe the pain. I recognize that all addictions, according to Dr. Maté, are about soothing pain, internal pain, especially, he says, childhood pain, abused children, neglected children, emotionally hurt children, over and over again. We can look at all the alcoholics in our life as feeding, soothing the pain from a childhood where there was either trauma or abuse. And so tonight we want to help those who might have an alcohol addiction to recognize, first of all, why they're using this substance to numb the pain. If someone's drinking every day especially, there's a lot of pain in there that they just can't handle. And they're probably being triggered daily. So so that the pain keeps coming up, whether it's continual verbal abuse or whatever memories they might have that just keep showing up. So we want to recognize tonight that we have a problem in our society, especially when it comes to our Native American sisters and brothers. They have been especially affected by this substance called alcohol. I want to just play a little bit about what happened with Pine Ridge. Pine Ridge is a reservation in this country that has had a serious, serious problem with alcohol addiction. And we can go back to colonial times when the Europeans brought this alcohol over and presented it to the Native Americans. And here's a little story about what's going on in Pine Ridge.
Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota is the epicenter of a crisis in American Indian life. To fight the alcoholism that is endemic here, the Oglala Sioux tribe has launched an unprecedented legal battle. It is seeking $500 million in damages from some of the world's largest beer brewing companies, as well as from liquor sellers in the town of White Clay, Nebraska, just across the border.
The Oglala Sioux tribe brought this lawsuit in hope that it would send a message out. Don't prey on our people because of their sickness.
White Clay, Nebraska, population 12, is less than 250 feet from the Pine Ridge Reservation, where it is not only illegal to possess or transport alcohol, but illegal even to have traces of it in your system. The tribe's lawsuit alleges that the defendants supply alcohol in a quantity far too large in an area where there is no place for it to be legally consumed. In 2010, its four liquor stores sold nearly 5 million cans of beer, nearly all thought to have been consumed by Pine Ridge residents. 40,000 people live on the vast reservation. Alcoholism is said to impact 85% of all families. Isolated, with few jobs and staggering unemployment, Pine Ridge is one of America's poorest patches, and its problems are handed down from generation to generation.
My kids all, my sister, every one of my kids are feeling drinks, and that's how two of my boys are in jail, and then I have one daughter that drinks a lot too. She's the one that left her kids with me. She drinks too much.
One in four children born on Pine Ridge has fetal alcohol syndrome. The newly built local jail here runs near capacity all the time.
Over 90% of my inmates are incarcerated for a charge that is related stemming from an incident involving alcohol consumption.
Some have argued that shutting down White Clay will only cause buyers to drive further down the road.
We will still find a way to go get what we need.
While closing off easy access to alcohol will only make it harder to get, if the lawsuit is successful, the tribe plans to use the money to build a treatment center and stimulate economic development.
The crisis mode is this. The addiction is very strong and it has a historical background to it.
Many at Pine Ridge are hoping that victory in the courts could help break the cycle of poverty and addiction more than a century in the making.
So we have had, those of us who have ties to the American or the Native American reservations and families, we've been aware of this for some time. And all you have to do is read your history of how alcohol was presented to our Native American ancestors as a way of getting land from the Native Americans. So the land was stolen using alcohol as a substance that changed the minds and hearts of the people so that they became more submissive to the idea of selling land and doing all kinds of things in the name of the European conquest and so much more. So when we come back from the break, we want to take your calls. I have a caller, it's press one. And if you have any questions or comments about your own struggles with alcohol, we welcome those so that others can be helped as well. It's time. It's time for this generation to start a new paradigm of no alcohol in the home. Because my parents, my home, my husband's home, we both had alcoholic parents, and we broke that curse in my home, at least with my husband and I. We had no alcohol. We didn't drink alcohol in my home, even though before I was married, I was all about the alcohol. But once we started raising a family, there was very little alcohol in our home. Now a new generation is back to drinking alcohol again. So we have another crisis. This generation seems to just have parties galore, and alcohol is always a big, big, big part of the parties. So we think we need to remind ourselves. That's what this show is all about, remind us of the problems we have. And I'm going to play an audio for you later where a guy says alcohol is the solution to his to the problem of dealing with emotions that can't be dealt with any other way. Now, I don't know if everybody believes that, but this is one person's testimony who finally woke up and changed his behavior, realizing the damage that it was doing. And that's usually what happens. The pain gets extreme. The damage shows up in the body. And then it'll pain is the pain, the physical pain, and along with the emotional pain that's being numbed, work together sometimes to bring about a change. So we're going to go to a commercial break.
Unmuted.
And we'll be right back after these messages. So stick and stay. Don't stray away.
Are you constantly arguing with your spouse? Are your children misbehaving and acting out? Is someone in your family abusing drugs? Have you been the victim of domestic violence? Are you grieving over the loss of a loved one? Let us help you restore serenity to your life. At Serenity Family Social Services, we understand that good mental health is the result of emotional well-being. Our goal is to assist you and your family in removing emotional distress and restoring harmony and balance to your lives. We offer individual, couples, and family counseling. I'm Howard Williams, CEO of Serenity Family Social Services. Call us today at 312-315-4820. That's 312-315-4820.
Do you want to live in a world without war? Join our global peace movement. Heavenly Culture World Peace Restoration of Light transcends culture, religion, ideology, and other boundaries to achieve a peaceful harmony in the global society. HWPL is committed to bringing world peace and cessation of war through peaceful dialogue between religious groups. I am Director Shin-Suk Kim of the HWPL Chicago Branch of North America. Join us for our next gathering. Call 773-580-1501 and be a part of the movement for world peace. Email us at chicagohwpl@gmail.com.
Our kids are the future and should not be left behind. One person should not decide what is the best for our 77 communities. Politicians must work together for our kids' best interests. They deserve a safe education with resources that meet every student need. Let's rebuild and restore Chicago. Vote for me for mayor of Chicago. I'm Dr. Willie Wilson, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Willie Wilson for mayor.
Okay, we're back. Thank you for joining us this evening. We appreciate your presence, your calls, your comments. And if you're just joining us, this week my mom, my mother, birth mother, would have been 95 years old. But she passed away at the age of 66 after a long, long struggle with alcohol. So I'm honoring her this week, today, especially for this show, dedicating the show to talking about the addiction of alcohol and how it can destroy the body and the family, in fact, because when people are drinking alcohol, they can sometimes become violent, threaten people, and then that can break up a marriage, a home, all kinds of negative occurrences, negative consequences when there's a family member who's drinking alcohol on a regular basis. So we want to bring some solutions tonight. And as one of my audios will show, this one person who overcame alcoholism thought looked at alcohol as a solution. And the solution would, the problem would be emotional pain. As Dr. Gabor mentioned and teaches, people who abuse alcohol, who use alcohol on a regular basis, are using that substance to soothe their pain, which is rooted in childhood abuses. And until you come to recognize that, if you have an alcohol problem or you're challenged with alcohol addiction, until you come to recognize that there's something deep within you that's in pain emotionally, usually from a childhood that was not so pleasant. So we're going to go to the phones, 336-350. Your mic's open. Mama AZ, how are you this evening?
Dr. Z?
Yes, ma'am.
I don't know.
Uh-oh. Emotions should come back to you.
I don't know.
How about I come back to you? I got another caller. Okay.
You don't need to come back. I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm good. When I was on my way to Pine Ridge for a ceremony in white clay, I have this old film about white clay. I got stopped by the popo, ticket $112. And this was in white clay. And it's a little junk town. And I got stopped out there by that liquor store. It's on film, that liquor store. Anyway, this is dedicated to my family, my mom especially. And I'm dealing with issues of alcohol fetal syndrome. But it's amazing that you have this subject today.
Yeah.
What does this day add up to? What number does it add up to?
I believe it's an 8. This is an 8.
Okay, that's the number of also, if it's an 8, that's Reverend Asa Allen's number. Who Reverend Allen is, just look up Miracle Valley. His mother was full-blooded Cherokee from Oklahoma, where my dad's people come from. And that this business of this white clay reservation, when I got stopped at that store, just a hop, skip, and a jump from Pine Ridge, going to do a ceremony at Chief Frank Fool's Crow's resting spot. We'll talk about that another time. But I'm contemplating on joining Alcoholic Anonymous. And because of my parents, and maybe I can learn something, because I'm in so much pain right now. I don't know what this is about, but listening to what you have put together, to me, it's like the universe is saying, don't throw the towel in yet, because there are people that are here to help you, Paris. Don't, or Mama AZ, or whatever. And Dr. V, you just don't know how connected you are. You go to your caller, because I'm going to put on mute and cry.
Okay, have a good cry. And The Most High will turn your mourning into dancing. I love that scripture. We are mourning for our parents, many of us who suffered and who had that emotional pain and using alcohol. In fact, I would say a whole generation of especially blacks who come from slave generations before alcohol was presented as relief for the emotional pain and suffering, and we're still struggling with that today. It's time to move to a new place of no alcohol, because it has destroyed families. It has destroyed alcohol, in my opinion, is if you become addicted and you're abusing it, slow suicide. It's slow. So you're going to pickle your organs and they will stop functioning. I watched it happen to my mother. And unfortunately, it alerts me to people who do have this issue that they could be pickling their organs. And until they get help for the pain, the emotional pain that they're going through, that the suicide will occur only slowly. So let me go to the next caller, 434-713. Your mic is open. Welcome. Give us your name, where you're calling from, please.
Yes, Gracie Parrish from Danville, Virginia. Hi, everybody.
Hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm. Doing okay. I found my answer today. First of all, I would like to speak to the doctor concerning the drugs. Now, I was got messed up on some drugs, which is the I couldn't sleep. And I went to the doctor, and I told her I couldn't sleep. And she put me on this particular drug, and she told me before my face, you will not be able to get off of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
wow.
I tried it for a while, about 3 weeks, and I said I wanted to just, you know, try to go to sleep on my own. Called her back, and she put me on this Sonona. Okay. It was pure hell. Hell. It was pure hell. I stayed from the bed back to my recliner. Climbed back to bed. I chose to do this way because if they had put me in the hospital, they would put me on more prescription drugs. So I don't take no prescription drugs. I don't take nothing over the counter. It's the grace of the Almighty that I'm here. I called my mom night and day for 3 weeks. 3 weeks. It was pure hell. I didn't want nobody to go through this. So I found my answer today. I don't know what the doctor would think about this, but I chose my path, Nana. Oh, I will spell her name. I'm pretty sure you know her. Her father passed. I don't remember the year he passed. Her first name is Ravita. His name and his daughter's name is Anoushka. So I'm gonna follow that path because that was the greatest peace, I ever experience. I read all different nationalities comment on that from different pains that they went through. One girl was addicted to drugs and she got herself off by listening to these people. And I'm going to stick with this. That grief that I was carrying where I lost my aunt from July 27th, and to the day, it was horrible for me. A man can't do anything for you. He can't. He just can't do anything for you. Peace. Peace through the singing of these letters, of these people, okay? My grandson, I have to tell him because his grandmama is from over in India. So I have to tell him about this. He don't know it yet. His dad don't know it. He's having some issues now. So since I'm learning about this, I'm going to stay on this path right here. The peace today, I will never forget. I'm going to stick by it. I'm going to stick by it.
Hallelujah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank us. You know, thank us for sharing our testimonies. That's why all of us should be sharing these testimonies to give people hope and to give people, encourage people that they can have peace. There's a scripture, I think it's Jeremiah 29, says the Creator says, I know the plans I have for you. Those who are listening, those who are in my kingdom, which is most of us, if you're conscious, the Creator says, I know the plans I have for you are to prosper, to be in peace, and to have a hope. And sometimes we don't really, if you don't read the Bible, you only hear that from someone like Gracie, who shares her testimony. That's why it's so important, whatever you're struggling with, share that so that others can have hope. Don't be afraid, don't be ashamed to share what your struggles are, especially if you're aware of your childhood abuses, neglect. We all have had some, and some people don't want to talk about it because of the religious upbringings that many have had and the controlling parents. People are afraid to talk about the influences that they've had in their childhood that have now created an alcoholic. And that's being self-centered in terms of not helping others to be in agreement with you and to get hope and peace, because the plans that the Creator says that they have for us to have peace and hope, I believe it's a thank us. When we share the testimonies that we are going through, that's where we can have the peace and the hope, knowing that everyone's going through the same thing. So here's a woman who testifies how she overcame her alcoholic addiction, because we want help. We want to know from others. Everyone's different, but you can overcome. Unfortunately, my mother overcame at a very late stage in her life after she had cirrhosis of the liver. I mean, it kept just graduating, and all the emotional roller coaster going back and forth in the hospital. And I witnessed all of that to now stand here with emotional intelligence, recognizing when I'm triggered with sadness about someone's alcoholic abuse. I recognize that as part of a childhood experience, that emotion came up a lot, viewing people who are in pain and they use alcohol to numb the pain. And then interpreting that trigger that I've had, sadness, what do I do with it? I turn that sadness into knowledge and sharing information with people about how they can overcome. So here's a testimony of one lady who overcame. Her name is Claudia Christian. She's an actress, a famous actress, I believe, and she gives her testimony, which we all should be doing, about how she overcame her alcoholism.
I've been in the entertainment industry for over 30 years. I was a very light drinker in my 20s. In my 30s, I was a social drinker. And somewhere in my early 40s, I developed alcohol use disorder, which is abbreviated AUD. We don't really use the term alcoholism that much anymore because it's too narrow of a term. AUD covers everything from the occasional binge drinker to the chronic daily drinker. I started to realize that something was very wrong with me when I was always the last person standing at the bar or at dinner parties when everybody else had switched to coffee. I was still quaffing wine. Yeah. I realized then that I definitely had a problem, so I decided that I would just go cold turkey, sober, and I did. But what I didn't realize is that could cause what's called the alcohol deprivation effect, where once the honeymoon period of sobriety wears off, you're left with constant physical cravings for alcohol. So think about it. You drive by a liquor store and you're triggered. You want a drink. You walk by a pub and you get angry because you can't go in there and have just one drink. You start isolating from your friends and families because they drink. Developing AUD was an incredibly confusing thing for somebody who admittedly likes to be in control. I was definitely not in control of this at all. In fact, I was swept up in a nearly decade-long battle with something I refer to as the monster. Addiction is a monster, and it affects every ethnicity, social class, race, sex, age. It doesn't matter. You can be the most disciplined person in the world. When it gets you, it has you. It is in control. When I finally realized that I was not in the driver's seat, that the monster was, I sought out every single treatment I could possibly find or afford. I went to rehab for $30,000 to basically drink wheatgrass and do Tai Chi. I went to talk therapy for over 2.5 years for $200 a session. I actually sought out a hypnotherapist who claimed that he had cured a member of the Grateful Dead. That was $400 an hour. I went to 12 different meetings of AA in 2 different countries. I went macrobiotic. I got my chakras realigned. I tried veganism. You name it, I tried it. And I prayed. Okay, I prayed until my knees were black and blue. And I still kept relapsing time and time again. I mean, I think that in the years that I was suffering from AUD and really battling it, I probably relapsed close to 20 times. And each relapse became more difficult to recover from. They got worse and worse and worse. And here's the thing. I wasn't drinking because I had a crummy childhood or because I was suffering from any personal trauma. I mean, if you look at it from the outside, I had a great life. I was in my chosen career. I had a beautiful home. I had friends and family who loved me and supported me. I was drinking because I was physically addicted to alcohol. That's it. Once I started, I could not stop drinking. I have addiction on both sides of my family, and the genetic predisposition coupled with engaging in the behavior, which for me is drinking, made me an addict. I knew one thing for sure after trying all of these treatments, and this became very clear. Doing equine therapy or Tai Chi in some swanky, beachfront, expensive rehabilitation facility was not going to fix my biological addiction. By the end of 2008, I had 6 months of sobriety under my belt, and that's when the addict started to talk to me in my head. That's the insidious thing about addiction, is once you have a little bit of sobriety under your belt, you go, hey, I'm not an addict. It whispers to you, go ahead, have a drink. You'll be able to control it, just one drink. So I listened to that idiot in my head, and I went out to dinner that night, and I had a glass of wine, and I came home, and I was so chuffed. Wow, look, the idiot's right. I'm not an addict. I only had one glass. Right. Day two, I had 2 glasses. Day three, I had 3 glasses, plus I picked up a bottle to bring home and drink on the way home. Day five, I was in a full-blown binge. I was drinking anything and everything. I would have probably drunk vanilla extract if I had it. When I was finally too ill to drink one more drop of alcohol, I did what I always did, went cold turkey and tried to detox. This time, something went very wrong. I started to suffer from seizures in my body. I lost all control of my motor controls. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't get dressed. So I called a friend, and she took me to my one and only medical detox. Where I got to tell you, I was not treated very well. In fact, until they had my $3,000, they finally gave me my medication that I needed to stop shaking. At that point, I felt so humiliated and so down and so embarrassed by the whole experience that I checked myself out and I left. On the way out, there was this little stack of flyers for all these different various treatments for AUD. One of them was for a shot. And this shot promised to eliminate all cravings for alcohol. The shot was over $1,000 a month. Yet at this point, I would have sold my soul to get better. When I got home, I Googled that shot. It turns out that the main ingredient in it is naltrexone, an FDA-approved, non-addictive, safe medication that's been used to treat AUD since 1994. As I was searching, a book popped up, the rather boldly named The Cure for Alcoholism by Dr. Roy Escapa. And there was this little sample chapter there, so I read the chapter, and I was absolutely hooked. This made complete sense to the science lover in my head. It described a treatment called the Sinclair Method, or TSM, where one takes an opiate blocker, you wait for an hour so the medication can get into your bloodstream and brain, and then you drink alcohol. Sounds counterintuitive, I know, but hear me out. Usually, when an addict drinks, they get a huge reward from alcohol, and that's what makes them want more and more and more. But if you drink on an opiate blocker like naltrexone or nalmefene, if you're here in the UK, instead of the alcohol reinforcing the addictive synapses in the brain, the opiate blocker blocks the endorphins from activating the part of the brain responsible for addiction. It's as if you have a huge room of endorphins living in your brain, right? And every time you drink alcohol, those endorphins rush through the door and they raise hell in your brain and your neural pathways. The opiate blocker stops those endorphins from even leaving the room. It slams that door and it locks it, so they can't even get out and play. Over the course of a couple days or weeks for some people, the body is slowly detoxed, drinking levels dramatically decrease because your cravings for alcohol subside. I didn't have a doctor that would prescribe me naltrexone back then. In fact, when I mentioned it to anybody, they said, what? So I ordered my pills from an Indian pharmacy online, 50 milligrams of hope. Took a couple of weeks for the pills to come to me, and when they did, I got to tell you, I was scared out of my mind because I thought, what if it doesn't work? What if it makes me relapse again? What if it's a worse relapse than the last one? But at this point, I was so desperate, I took my chance. So I took the pill, I waited the hour, I poured myself a glass of wine, and it was a miracle. I mean, the wine just sat there while I ate my dinner. There was no head games, no compulsion, no, I want more, 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 nothing. I took a couple of sips and I went, meh, I'm done. It was a complete miracle. 3 months into TSM, I had my true aha moment. There was this billboard, I hate this billboard, near where I lived in Los Angeles, and every time I drove by it, I had a huge glass of red wine on it, which was my particular poison, massive glass. Every time I drove by that billboard, it would trigger me. If I was in drink mode, it would trigger me. I'd go, I want more. If I was in sober mode, I would drive by that billboard and I'd go, damn it, I can't have a glass of wine. This particular day, I drove by that billboard, and my brain said to me, that's just a billboard. I can't even explain to you what a profound moment this was, because it meant that my thought processes were normal again. It meant that my brain was fixed. It meant that I was me again. 6 months into TSM, I was mostly sober, except for the occasional planned drink 1 hour after taking naltrexone. TSM worked so well for me that I decided to contact Dr. Roy Escapa and thank him for writing his book.
Then in her testimony goes on a little long, but I was really impressed that she recognized the trigger, and that's what we started talking about last week. Emotional intelligence, developing that is about recognizing the triggers that cause you to go into behavior like alcohol drinking or smoking or whatever addiction that you're practicing. That recognizing is the first step to developing that emotional balance where you don't react to billboards or any other outside element that causes you to go into negative or weaken the behavior. So I love that. And her journey is very unique and different. Of course, the money was there to invest in programs. And that's just one way to work with that. Dr. Debbie Green has her own protocol where she uses affirmations, 45-second rule with thought shifting interrupts the addictive process with her patients. She says it has a spiritual component, And then she says there's a treatment for 6 to 8 weeks for psychotherapy with med management. So Dr. Debbie Green is very active in helping people overcome their addictions. She says that mindset creates physical effect addiction. The brain is hardwired. So, so true. And let me go back a minute. Naima was asking the question. So Dr. Gabor did say when you're abused as children, your brains lose the ability to produce certain hormones. Dr. Debbie says dopamine is one. So, yes, Dr. Gabor Maté, the addictive psych physician, teaches us that the children who are abused have their brains wired a certain way because of that abuse. And that goes with just about any trauma that a person may have in their childhood. I've learned from German New Medicine that any time a person, especially children, are involved in some type of major trauma, the brain picks up that energy and creates a lesion of some sort on the brain. And that's when people can develop cancer in some parts of the body if they don't resolve that that trauma and come to peace with it. So recognizing the triggers, that's one of the first things, and then interpreting them as the audio told us, and then processing it in whatever you think best. That will bring you that peace and that healing that is so needed when you've been numbing the pain with alcohol, drugs, whatever. So we're at the top of the hour again, and let's see. If Naima, if you're ready for commercials, I will open your mic, and then I have another testimony. And then we have a caller. When we come back, we'll go to 706-202. And I have another testimony I want to share with you about an athlete's journey who finally realized how dangerous the alcohol was, how unbelievably dangerous the alcohol
Unmuted.
Was. So I'm going to open up the mic of our executive producer, and we're going to hear some commercials, I think. And we'll be right back after the commercials. Hello, Christina. Christina says, Jula says, hello, everyone. And I didn't hear from Naima, so maybe she's not ready. So let's see. Not sure what happened to Naima. So we will go to our caller, and when I hear
muted
from Naima, we'll come back to the commercial. 706-202, your mic's open. I believe this is Kwame Sunhorse.
Good evening, Sister Viata. Excellent show, and most important information to be sharing, because this is a... It has been on this Turtle Island an epidemic since they arrived here with it. But the thing that we're looking at is that you've described, and I like the clip that you did, and her finding out that there are medications that help to the TM, whatever it was. But what I'm sharing to what I wanted to talk about is the epigenetics, and that in the part of our DNA that if you had a parent or you had fetal alcohol syndrome, your chances of becoming the alcoholic, you may not get there. Everybody does it. Like Gabor Monte says, trauma and environment create the addict. Trauma and environment create the addict. And what we're looking at is those are triggers that have been passed down in genes that if you get in a certain environment, if you're raised in a certain environment, in a certain household, your chances of creating and repeating that genetic trait is fire, because I told my first four daughters, I told them, you know, I said, your chances of becoming like I was is greater because you have a tolerance in the beginning, but your, as Gabor says, is that it gives you pleasure in the moment, but it causes you problems over time. It gives you pleasure in the moment. It causes problems over time. And so what happens is that person finds that, oh, yeah, you know, I'm drinking an ounce of courage. Or when I drink, I feel better. I look better. I am better. And so what we see is that what she was talking about and being able to put all of those synapses in one part of the brain and lock the door and they don't respond, those are triggers. That's what I'm talking about, the genetics. Those are genes that are programmed. And what science has been able to do is to use that and that. But also what I like about what I've been working with, Wellbriety and Native American spirituality, it uses the forest and nature and spirituality along with the 12 steps of the Native American program. And so it's a combination, because that means if that person is using that substance, that medication, that means that that person is substituted. You just took one habit and you replaced it with another habit, because I have to take this not to do this. So what we're looking at is how do you eliminate and be able to use your higher power and your own natural endorphins to be able to regulate how you feel about yourself. It's an inside job. And
yeah,
it's part that a person looks at and saying that, oh, they should be, you should be able to quit doing this. You should be able, but you don't know what goes inside that person. And that trauma and those turmoils and constantly having that activation occur. You can be walking and have a smell and it will trigger you. You can look at I remember a friend of mine was watching the movie Scarface, and he was a crack addict. And he was calling me and asking, he said, man, I got to get up and go use. And I said, no, you don't. All you got to do is turn the channel, turn the movie off. Because what we do is that we develop a habit, and we have to replace the habit. And so, like you said with Dr. Green and saying using mantras and using affirmations, is that you have to reprogram your programming. That's what Bruce Lipton talks about when he says that you can reprogram those programs that are in you once you see how they're working. And so these are the ways in which to do what needs to be done to saving the person. And so it's good information, and it what works for one person may not work for another. It's just they've got one of the greatest treatments that comes out of the continent of Africa is Ibogaine. Ibogaine will cure heroin addiction, alcohol addiction, any addiction. When you go through the treatment of using that natural plant, it gets rid of all of that addiction, all of those synapses the person does. But
now,
in the country, Gabor uses it in Canada. You
okay.
can get it. They have places in Mexico that you can go and have treatment. And this is how people are getting over these addictions, because that would be a great tool to use with the fentanyl and opioids and the alcoholism, because alcohol in itself is what brought the whole thing of the slave trade and the missionary schools when they used, because that's what they used to give to their conquerors. They gave them alcohol in order, what the Native American calls it, the mind changer. Because that's what it does. The African, the spirit changer. Because you're pouring spirits into the person. That's what's put on the bottle. It says it on the bottle. Spirits. And so how you being a spirit, a spiritual person, going to pour another spirit into you, it will, that spirit will take over, as the old saying goes. The man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, the drink takes the man. Because those spirits will overcome and take your spirit from you.
So I'm so glad you are bringing up all these options that people have. And Dr. Green says words have power to the brain and in life. So there's so much help available to anyone who's struggling with alcohol or drugs and overusing them, abusing them. But that person has to have the desire to stop. And as Dr. Gabor Maté says, he's at a very poor rate of helping people survive their addiction, because it's a very powerful influence over the brain and the heart and the mind and body when people are addicted. So we know it's not easy. And I'm grateful for Dr. Green sharing her experience, her wisdom, and you sharing that there's so many options for people to get the help they need, but they have to have the desire first and foremost. Because and I think with Dr. Gabor's teaching about the childhood abuses that are at the root, he has had 100%. Of the patients that he's worked with, he has found that they've had some type of childhood abuse when they have serious addictions. So the individual
right.
has to come to grips with that and look at their childhood and have an understanding or an acceptance.
They need help looking at this. They need help because that's what's causing the addiction, is what they see. But what they have to be able to have someone to guide them in what we call ACL, adult children of alcoholics. You're not the problem. You were in an environment, a family, a situation. And the thing that we found that works when we take people out of the cities and bring them into the nature and put them there, and there's a transformation. And so the longer you stay connected in nature, the longer that you change your energy. And the same thing that happens when you lock people up in prison. When you send that person off to prison, they have to find, because they're locked in a cell, maybe with somebody else or maybe but they're locked away with themselves. And that's where you reach people. That's where Don Coyes would reach. That's where the Nation of Islam reaches its place. It goes into the prison ministry, and you go and you get that man or that woman while they're out of that environment that created the person that got sent there. You have to remove the person from what damaged them. You can't do it in a community that every, like she said, she drives on the highway and she see the billboard, it's a trigger. That's the environment. It's created to keep you in that addictive behavior. So is buying a shopaholic or a person that wants all the time. There are many ways of addiction, food addiction. You drive through the community and churches, chicken, Popeyes, McDonald's, Burger King. Those are triggers for feeding the body death. Those are triggers.
And as Dr. Green says, there's no more victim mentality. I think that's part of the problem even today in our communities, is that we have too many people who are crying, I'm a victim, I'm a victim. And the power is in being victorious and taking self-responsibility. So I want to play one. I don't know what happened tonight.
Can I share one thing?
Sure, go ahead.
I sent you okay. Illinois. Illinois is one of the leading states of depopulation. There are so many people, and they were showing the communities You talk about Cairo, Illinois. You talk about Kankakee, Harvey. The poorest place in the United States is East Chicago Heights. The poorest place, and you have a major metropolitan city, and Chicago Heights, just south of Chicago, is one of the poorest communities in the nation. So you have major metropolitan, that's why I share in saying that we got to get out of these urban plantations. It's by design for those weak minds.
Yeah, so that's the first step in developing emotional intelligence. And Kwame is saying recognizing not just the words that were spoken to you that triggered you, the billboard, but the environment. Recognizing what kind of environment am I in that I keep getting triggered into this low frequency of victim mind and poor me and fear and anxiety and all those things that can cause a person to feel pain, emotional pain, and then want to reach for a substance to soothe the pain instead of processing, interpreting, and processing. And Dr. Green said, anything done with consistency and extreme can be an addictive behavior. Yeah, absolutely. So that there's so much to learn. There's so much to learn. Once the person can admit that they have an addiction or that they're looking for substances to soothe their pain, emotional pain that keeps getting triggered. So waiting for Naima to come back, but in the meantime, let me play another testimony from an athlete by the name of Rich Rolls' story about how he says alcohol is unbelievably dangerous. And it's really interesting how people come to the conclusions they come to about alcohol, but it's refreshing because they have a lot of pain. There's a song by the Imagine Dragons. My granddaughter loves this song, and I was listening to the words of this song, and it's called Believer, but he became a believer through the pain. And it's really powerful words, and I'm starting to like the music even because every time we go to the Y, we have to listen to her music. And I'm like, I like this song because the words are really powerful. I became a believer because of the pain. So here's another testimony by a guy by the name of Paul Churchill. I think it's his name. He's an athlete, and how he was duped with alcohol.
I feel like I've been duped. I recall in high school, the motivational speakers would come to my school and say, don't do drugs. Don't do crack. Don't do heroin. Don't do cocaine. And don't do meth. I'd say to myself, okay, I heard you loud and clear. I won't do drugs. But absent from those talks was any reference to alcohol. From what I saw on TV, in the movies, as far as I was 21, everything was going to be just fine. I started drinking in college, and I loved it. I had a great time. I started to drink more and more, and I became enchanted with it. After majoring in business and Spanish, I had the brilliant idea to move to Granada, Spain, and buy a bar. Looking back, it was clear I had a drinking problem at the time. And what ensued over the following 3 years can be summarized with three words: total shit show. Now, my drinking became so bad in Spain, I was blacking out 5 to 7 nights per week. 20 to 25 drinks a night, that was the norm. One night, I ended up in the emergency room. I was thinking I was having a heart attack, but it ended up being alcohol-induced withdrawal symptoms and a severe anxiety attack. I said to myself, what in the hell is going on? I'm a smart guy. Why can't I beat this? Well, my drinking only increased. So I did a smart thing. I walked away from the bar in Spain, hoping a geographical change would cure my drinking. But it didn't taper off. In fact, it escalated. At a time when it seemed my friends were phasing out of their heavy drinking days, I was ramping up. I began to wonder, what is going on? So I decided to do some research, and I went to Dr. Google. Now, with the help of Dr. Google, I found an episode on the Freakonomics podcast with a Dr. David Nutt, who was hired by the British government to place a harm score on 20 of the world's most addictive drugs. And his findings surprised me. He found that magic mushrooms do the least amount of harm to those who take them and others. And guess what landed at number one? It wasn't meth. It wasn't crack. It wasn't cocaine or heroin. It was alcohol. Duped. I felt like I'd been totally and completely duped by alcohol. And why hadn't I known it could be so dangerous? Well, it turns out that alcohol is quite addictive. And what I didn't hear from those speakers and motivational speakers in elementary school and middle school, high school, was that alcohol kills more people each year than every other drug combined. Nearly 33% of all traffic fatalities involve alcohol, around 11,000 in this country alone. 85,000 Americans, over 3 million people worldwide, will die this year to alcohol-related causes. So at age 28, I decided to quit permanently, but I couldn't. Due to the addictive properties of alcohol, I get dragged down in a vicious cycle of addiction again. I get a week, a month, a year, only to be dragged down in addiction again. But finally, after a decade of being sick and tired of being sick and tired and a failed suicide attempt due to that damn stigma, on September 7th, I got sober. Now let me tell you why this is my most crowning achievement in life. 5% of people will make it to 90 days. Of those, only 5% will make it to 2 years. That's 2.5 people out of 1,000 will make it to 2 years of sobriety after they make the decision to quit drinking. So with 2 months of sobriety, I went to an AA meeting. I was ducking and dodging behind trees, thank you, stigma, and two things came to mind. Number one, I knew I was going to drink again if I didn't do something different. Number two, there are so many people struggling. Why are we so secretive about our drinking? So I selfishly started the Recovery Elevator podcast to create accountability for myself. I didn't care who listened. If it was just me, my brother, my mom, and my dad, then great, as long as I stayed sober. If I helped a couple other people along the way, then that's a huge bonus. However, what happened next blew my mind. The podcast has been downloaded over 1 million times in all 50 states and over 140 countries. Now, I'd like to think it's because I'm a highly skilled interviewer or that my topics are incredibly insightful, but I know it's because there's so many people out there struggling with alcohol. And what I've learned after having 120 interviewees on the podcast is that alcoholism is not an indication of weak morals or that one lacks the muscle of willpower, and it does not discriminate. I've interviewed doctors, lawyers, engineers, even the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Now, in 1956, the American Medical Association classified alcoholism addiction as a disease. In 2016, Surgeon General Vivek Murthy recognized addiction as a chronic disease of the brain worthy of compassion just like any other chronic disease, like diabetes or heart disease. Why we're still having the debate if alcoholism addiction is a disease or not is a mystery to me. But I do know that it has something to do with the stigma. And it's this stigma that forces us to reach our most severe moments in pain before reaching out for help. And oftentimes, it's too late. Me publicly coming out as someone with a drinking problem has been the best thing that I've ever done for myself. I created accountability. I found a way to help myself by helping others. And as a result, I'm approaching 3 years of sobriety this coming September. Thank you. Thank you very much. That means a lot. Now, with so many people struggling and the odds not in our favor, how do we beat this? How do we return to a life of happiness? We must be clear that we are facing two mighty adversaries. Number one, a dangerous and addictive drug called alcohol. And number two, the stigma surrounding addiction. What I have learned from after hundreds of conversations with those who have been successful in sobriety is through community is the best way to face this issue. Now, regarding the stigma, it's time to shred the shame. This is a disease just like cancer. Now imagine if someone were to notice a mole on the back of their arm that was rapidly changing size, color, and shape. They'd get it checked out pretty quick. Now, with alcoholism, the opposite happens. We try to keep it a secret. We place unrealistic rules and strategies into place. Now, it's the silence and anonymity that perpetuates the stigma surrounding addiction. So I encourage you, if you're struggling with alcohol or you know someone who is, don't be so secretive about it. Reach out before it's too late, because it's easy and understandable for one to be duped by alcohol when people rarely talk about it. Thank you.
So that's my message today. Don't be secret about your alcohol use. And especially if you're aware that it's out of control or you're abusing it or if it's excessive. The idea is to help others. And if you're going through that struggle right now, there are thousands of others who are right there with you, and you can help other people. There are some people in my life who say they help a lot of people, and they're good at what they do, and they're always reaching out to the homeless and this and that. But if you were to have an alcohol problem and you're hiding that with all the people that you come in contact with and you're hiding that from all these people, then you are being entirely selfish, more selfish about your alcohol problem than any other thing that you're doing, because there are so many people out there who need help with alcohol addiction. So I want to encourage anyone out there who's struggling with alcohol, be kind to yourself. Admit that you're struggling, and don't feel shame. I know that there's probably a lot of shame being triggered when people decide to drink alcohol, and that's what the steps to recognizing emotional intelligence development is, recognizing if you're feeling shame about something which causes you to drink alcohol, and then there's this vicious cycle. But if we can recognize it and then interpret that trigger and then reach out for help. There's all the people tonight are offering suggestions and ways that we can get help if we have a problem. And so there's really no excuse these days. It's time for us to develop what Kwame calls the Overground Railroad. I interviewed a young man on my YouTube channel who is building a village in Georgia with over 100 acres of land. And this is what I would call the Overground Railroad, where we have people throughout this country who are buying land, developing it, and it'll be a place to retreat to help develop when stuff hits the fan, when there's no more food in the grocery stores. We're going to need villages like this. And one of the rules of this village is that there's no alcohol or drugs in this village, and that's definitely what's needed to have a safe, harmonious, and peaceful community. Again, the Creator wants us all to be living in peace, prosper and have hope. And we're only going to be in peace, prospering, hope when we stick together, as one of the speakers has mentioned. Stick together and develop communities that are supporting one another when we struggle. I'm going to go ahead and play one of my commercials, then we'll come right back after this message. Let's see. Here we go.
The Female Solution Global Radio TV Show invites you to an invigorating conversation with our team of hosts Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Time. Start your week with Monday Morning Mindfulness with Zelda Speaks. Tuesdays, Self-Care with Jody Susan. Wednesdays, Repairing Broken Families with Naima Latif and co-host Kareem Hamid. Thursdays, Soulful Solutions with Dr. Debbie Green. And Fridays, Health and Well-Being with Beata. Saturdays, tune in 12 noon to 2 p.m. Central Time. First Saturday, Success Strategies with Jana. Second Saturday, Wendy Williams Esquire on Relationships. Third Saturday, Move Around with Deborah. And fourth Saturday, Wisdom with Mama D. Join us Sundays, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Central Time for Soul Purpose Healing with Beata. Call in and comment, 515-605-9325. Press 1 to speak to the host and be a part of the solution.
And that was our short commercial break, and I have one more testimony I'd like to share with you. I think this is the one I mentioned, but Rich Rose, an athlete story.
Alcohol is the solution to the problem, and it works until it stops working. Even though I had accomplished certain things as a swimmer and had sort of distinguished myself academically, I was still very much a navel gazer. You know, I couldn't talk to a girl. I just wasn't comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah.
I felt like, and you hear this in AA a lot, like everybody else had the rule book for life, and I was sitting on the outside, like marveling at how people seemed to, you know, gracefully navigate the world, where I just felt, you know, anxious all the time. And alcohol solved that problem. Like, I have a lot of love for it. Like, it gave me social tools that I lacked and taught me how to be a social animal in a social situation. Suddenly I could go to a party and crack a joke and flirt with a girl and do all these things that were beyond my capacity to handle prior to that. So it's not all bad. Like, it worked, you know,
right,
what I mean? Which is why I doubled down on it.
Right.
Like, the cure for alcoholism isn't removing alcohol. Alcohol is the solution to the problem, and it works until it stops working.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while before it stopped working in my case. But the ism remains once you remove the substance. You can't blame anyone else, and it's not about anything external. It's only about your relationship with you. And you're still going to be, you know, impulsed by your innate biases and however your hardwiring has set you up to, you know, perceive the world. But you get that extra little moment of recognition to course correct, you know. And, I would say that I become, you know, I got sober in 98. So I've been in this thing for a long time. And when I came in, I just thought, oh, it's drug addicts and alcoholics. That's what addiction is. But I've become convinced that addiction lives on this massive spectrum. And we are all victims of addiction on some level, some mild and some extreme, from, you know, the guy lying in the gutter with a bottle to the guy who can't pull the needle out of his arm, to the compulsive scrolling while we're taking a, you know, or the guy who, or the woman
deep.
Who,
that one runs deep,
goes, yeah, who goes from bad relationship to bad relationship,
sure,
you know, repeating a certain pattern because there's something about that that they can't, there's a compulsivity to that that they can't control. So I think thinking about addiction more broadly makes it applicable and instructive and useful for people as they develop enough self-awareness to have objectivity on how they maneuver the world and the daily habits that they continually find themselves, you know, falling prey to that are leading their lives in the wrong direction.
And the impulse to addiction, this, the way that we're wired, it doesn't have to all be bad, because I knew someone, I dated her before I'm, you know, got with my wife, and her name is Maya, and we actually did a podcast on gratitude. And what I found about her is she had a daily gratitude practice that was unbroken for 7 years. And she was addicted to gratitude, like literally addicted to gratitude. And it was amazing. She was such a happy person.
Yeah.
She forged that addiction.
But it is a practice, right?
Absolutely.
So it didn't come. She didn't necessarily wake up feeling grateful.
Nope.
But by dint of, you know, her allegiance to that practice,
becomes that which she aspired to become. And it wasn't a, it was a 30-minute practice. Like, it was like a legit practice that she did. She had a whole curriculum that she had developed, and being grateful for different aspects of her life. And so that's possible with the same mechanism that drives people to all of the things that you mentioned prior. The same mechanism can kick in and get you addicted to those things.
The kind of final chapter in my alcoholism, just to disabuse everybody of any kind of romantic Bukowski notion of what it was like. I was not, you know, penning the great American novel or doing anything creative. I was by myself, drinking alone, often waking up in the morning and having a vodka tonic in the shower and working as a lawyer and trying to sneak drinks throughout the day. Like, it was exhausting. It was sad and lonely. I had burned bridges with friends. I was unreliable. My parents didn't want anything to do with me. And, you know, ultimately, I had a marriage that ended on the honeymoon. Like, I had, I created a lot of chaos and wreckage and destroyed a lot of relationships and just became, you know, a irresponsible, unreliable member of society, living like two blocks from here, sleeping on a bare mattress on the floor of an apartment with no furniture, and, you know, the phone wasn't ringing. I'd gotten two DUIs. I was looking at possible jail time. I was going to get fired from my job, and just woke up one day, you know, after a bender, and nothing particularly terrible had happened that night, but I had kind of reached that nadir where I was like, I can't do this anymore. And I had been seeing an addiction therapist, and he was like, are you ready? And he's like, I got a bed for you, and ended up going up to Oregon and checking into a rehab, thinking I was going to do a quick couple-week spin dry because I was so important and I had to get back to my job. And, you know, had this epiphany, you know, coming to there that I, you know, my best thinking, I thought, oh, well, I'm a smart guy. I was literally, you know, institutionalized. And that landed on me like a ton of bricks. And I just realized, like, I better figure this out because the future is not looking bright. And started opening up and taking direction and listening and letting go of how I thought things should be. And for the first time was honest about the things that I was doing and the ways that I was behaving. And the, you know, I remember a counselor telling me, like, you know, you have a case of alcoholism that we typically only see in like 65-year-old men who come in here who have been drinking for the better part of their lifetime. And if you don't get this, like, you're probably going to die. And he just said it so point blank, like, I'll never forget it, and it scared the shit out of me. So he said, I know that you think you're going to spin out of here in 28 days, but we think you should stick around. And I just said, I'll stay here as long as you think I should be here. And I ended up living there for 100 days, which is kind of a long time to be in rehab.
Sure.
But that saved my life. There's so much capability that resides within all of us. And, you know, like yourself, I've had the privilege of sitting across from so many people who've done extraordinary things, and you see the humanity in all of them, and we project this superhero quality onto all these people, but they're all just human beings who had a dream and worked hard to achieve it. And it's inspiring to really own and grasp the idea that you know, we're all sitting on top of deep reservoirs of potential that remain untapped, and our job is to, you know, figure out how to authentically, you know, connect with that voice that is telling us to, you know, unlock something and share it with the world. And if you can do that and then share that story and tie it in some way to service as a teacher or in some way that can inspire other people or pave the way for a better world, I mean, that to me is the recipe for a good, purpose-driven, fulfilling life. I'm much more focused on what I'm doing today and how I can, you know, leverage these tools that I've learned to ameliorate, you know, the disease of it as it rears its head and other kind of behavioral stuff. Like, I don't.
So that's, again, one man's story, and I want to share the Native American story because this hits where to our ancestors. And how we should be almost angry at the tactics that were used against our Native American ancestors and the condition that many of them find themselves in. And the key here, I want you to think about the key here. Alcohol was used to steal the land, to so influence the psyche, the body, and the mind of Native Americans that they would give away land. And now those of you who continue to abuse alcohol and put it in your body, your land, your body is being stolen from the Creator's love, compassion, wisdom, when you choose to numb the pain with this alcohol created by man. Let's rethink about and just remember the Native American story.
Alcoholism is a disease that plagues the Native American population to an outstanding degree. One of the biggest concerns in the Native American community is the overwhelming presence of alcoholism. Studies show that the rate of alcoholism among Native Americans has been the highest in nearly 100 years running. On October 4th, the Health and Human Services Department issued the results of its national survey of substance abuse in 2000, stating that the rate of current illicit drug use was the highest among the American Indian Alaska Native population, at 12.6% compared with 6.4% for each white and black, 5.3% were for Hispanics, and 2.7% were for Asians. Native Americans and alcoholism is a big issue that hinders the community till this day.
American Indians didn't typically drink alcohol or didn't traditionally drink alcohol, and alcohol was introduced into our communities during the colonial period, and some of the founding fathers, Franklin and Jefferson come to mind, were really specific about wanting to get Native people hooked on alcohol so that we would become indebted to them, and through that debt we would be forced to give up our land. And so in some of our early religious movements, a figure in my tribe, Denskwatawa, also known as the Shawnee Prophet, is someone who, along with Wovoka and Handsome Lake, talked with Native people about putting away the things of the whites. That's what they would say. And it was because they saw the destruction in our communities that came from consumption of alcohol, came from forms of Christianity, and just generally deviating from our traditional ways of being. Fast forward to contemporary times, a lot of alcoholism in Native community, in my opinion, has to do with historical trauma, and specifically that our children were stolen from our homes, taken and placed in boarding schools where they weren't Indian and they weren't white. And so they came out into the world again having really depreciated self-concepts, and all they could think of to do to mediate the bad feelings that they had was to consume alcohol or to take drugs. And so, you know, they weren't functioning people. They will have children who then aren't parented, and then they don't learn how to be functional people. So for me, the role of historical trauma can't be understated when we consider alcoholism in our nation.
Native tribes have produced weak beers, wines, but they have a low alcohol concentration that were used only for ceremonial purposes. When the Europeans began introducing alcohol to Native Americans, they had very little time to adapt to the guidelines or knowledge of alcohol use. Trades would use the large demands of alcohol by trading for animal skins, materials, and resources. They discovered that giving free alcohol to Natives made the trade sale a higher sale. Intoxication was common amongst colonialists, but not to the inexperienced Native population. The Natives' first response to alcohol was with dissatisfaction and suspicion. Europeans ensured Natives alcohol were not too taboo, but rather a gift to the Native community. In turn, Native drunkenness had been associated with the inferiority of the Native race, and myths came were thought about. The Firewater myth represented the history, nature, sources, and potential solutions to Native American alcohol problems. These myths stated that Native American people had a natural craving for alcohol. Natives were sensitive to alcohol, thus creating alcoholism as one of the biggest Native substance abuse trends in the Native population. Research suggests that the roots of the epidemic of alcohol-related problems among many Native Americans are found in the cultural responses to the European arrival, the role of the alcohol in the frontier society, and colonial and post-colonial policies. Evidence from the historical record is considered within the framework of the current social science. SASMA, the National Household Survey on Drug Abuse from 1991 to 1993, indicates that the 3.5 of their entire sample can be classified as alcohol-dependent. The white non-Hispanic and black non-Hispanic groups had a similar rate of 3.4% of alcohol dependence, while the rates for Native Americans was 5.6. The rates of alcohol dependence were lowering among the Hispanic respondents, like the National Household Survey. They also found that the group of Asian Americans had a higher rate of abstinence and lower rates of heavy alcohol consumption compared to whites, African Americans, and Native Americans. Muncher Holder and Trouble, 1990, observed that an aggregate sample of Native Americans used alcohol did so at an early age and drank more heavily compared to any other ethnic group in the United States. Prohibition has been the most prevalent policy in attempting to reduce alcohol consumption among Indian tribes. Although it is not inconsistently applied in colonial times, tribe as well as non-Indian authorities attempted to limit the sale or importation of alcohol within Indian territories. These bans were mostly ineffective. However, because alcohol was involved in lucrative trading and someone was always willing to distribute, in 1832, the U.S. Congress passed legislation banning the sale of alcohol beverages to Indian people. The legislation was repealed in 1953, and tribes are given the option of retaining prohibition or allowing the sale of consumption of alcohol on reservations. Policies regulating the sale and use of alcohol can serve as an important tool in preventing alcohol problems and merit increased attention among tribes. However, these policies may succeed to some extent in community settings such as reservations. They may be difficult to implement in urban or rural settings in which urban Indians are only a small portion of the total population. Currently, many different agencies implement alcohol policies and claim some responsibility for lowering the rates of alcohol use. As a result, policies are inconsistent, contributing to the uncertainty in the Indian community. Although these sanctions are used against illegal use, policy alone is not the only route to prevention, but it does help address the powerful factors leading to alcohol abuse. In recent decades, prevention of alcohol abuse has been a high priority within American Indian communities. Community leaders, school personnel, and health providers have recognized the toll that alcohol is taking and have instituted a variety of prevention interventions. The IHS, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and numerous federal research and service organizations have been involved with providing resources for prevention. The IHS has provided treatment for alcohol abuse and alcoholism since its inception in 1975. In addition to numerous tribally-based programs, this agency currently funds 7 regional treatment facilities for women and 12 for adolescents. The Indian Health Services, such as the Alcohol and Substance Abuse Program, is a program for American Indian and Alaskan Native individuals to reduce the evidence of and prevalence of alcohol and substance abuse. These programs are administrated in tribal communities, including emergency, inpatient and outpatient treatment, and rehabilitation services for individuals covered under the Indian Health Services. These services address and treat alcoholism from a disease model perspective. The Tribal Action Plan helped to create the American Indian and Substance Abuse Prevention Treatment Act of 1986. This act was created to work with federal agencies to assist Native American communities, as well as gathering funding to help migrate levels of alcohol and substance abuse among the Native American population. Certain organizations, such as the American Indian Committee on Alcohol and Substance Abuse and the Native American Health Center, are organizations to help reduce alcohol abuse among Native Americans.
The Valentine East Side of Vancouver, British Columbia is one of the world's ground zeros for addiction, and that in a few square block radius we have thousands of people injecting, inhaling, and ingesting drugs of all kinds and paying dearly for it. These people are often outside the law, certainly beset by many medical problems due to ingestion drug use, including psychosis, including HIV, including hepatitis C, cancers. They die of overdoses. This is trench warfare, and the people that are the frontline soldiers dying from it are the people affected by addiction. So that's where I worked for 12 years. And what I learned could be summed up really very briefly by saying that addiction is not a choice that anybody makes. It's not a moral failure. It's not an ethical lapse. It's not a weakness of character. It's not a failure of will. It's just how our society depicts addiction. Nor is it an inherited brain disease, which is how the medical tendency is to see it. What it actually is, it's a response to human suffering. And all these people that I worked with have been severely traumatized as children. All the women had been sexually abused. All the men had been traumatized, some of them sexually, physically, emotionally neglected. And not only is that my perspective, it's also what the scientific and research literature shows. So addiction then is actually, rather than being a disease as such or a human choice, it actually is, it's an attempt to escape suffering temporarily. By the time I went to work there, I had already been in family practice for 20 years. I'd seen a lot, and I was quite attuned to the impact of early childhood experiences on adult psychology and adult brain physiology. But I just hadn't seen the depth and the degree until I went to work down there. So really it dramatized and confirmed for me, made it very palpable how addictions are a response to suffering, and that what people need in response to addiction is not judgment and not simply symptom control. They need to be helped to heal from their trauma, because it is all about trauma. The media, the television, cultural depiction of addicts is usually as desperate people, but without showing why they're desperate. So all they show is the desperation for the drugs. There's no indication of what's driving that desperation. And hence you see them behaving in all kinds of dysfunctional ways, aggressive or manipulative or unpleasant. But again, there's no three-dimensional sense of the reality of these people as to what that's really all about for them. Is it possible to cure people? You're speaking from the Western model, where I am the expert, and you're the one with the disease, and I'm going to cure you, like you cure a piece of meat. You know, no. The answer to that question, framed that way, is no, it's not possible. If you're asking, is it possible for people to heal from trauma sufficiently that they don't have to keep escaping into addictions to lessen the suffering of their trauma, yes, that's entirely possible. But the question is, under what conditions is that possible? And under the conditions that obtain in London, UK, or Vancouver, British Columbia, or New York, New York, or any place, under the conditions that obtain socially, legally, and from the perspective of medical practice, it's hardly a likelihood, because we're approaching it from the wrong direction and with the wrong perspective. If I could constantly demonstrate that with this particular population, I could affect a 5 or 10% success rate of getting people to leave their addiction behind, I'd be considered to be a genius, because our results are so poor. When I say ours, I don't mean ours specifically in Vancouver. I don't mean that. I mean the overall treatment model for addiction is so poor in succeeding with the most affected segments of the population. So, I mean, addictions are like everything else on a spectrum. So a lot of people do heal from addictions, but the most inveterate, most entrenched addicts, they have the hardest time. And they're also the ones whom society gives the hardest time, so that it makes it even harder to help them. Never mind they don't get the help they need, they actually get actively punished. And so what you've actually got is traumatized children, and children are traumatized, that affects how they feel about themselves, which is deeply ashamed, because a child always believes that it's about himself. So if I'm being hurt like this, I gotta be a terrible person. Or if I was sexually abused, why didn't I fight back? I must be a very weak person. So there's a deep sense of shame. Then there's tremendous emotional pain that accrues from abuse and neglect. Tremendous emotional pain that is hardly possible for people to bear. Now they have to soothe their pain with substances or their compulsive behaviors. Then the trauma itself, given that the human brain develops in interaction with the environment, shapes the brain circuitry in such a way that the person will be more likely to find relief from the drugs. So the very physiology of the brain is affected by early trauma. So then you take these traumatized people and you make their habit illegal. It's not illegal to drink yourself to death. It's not illegal to make yourself sick with emphysema or lung cancer by means of cigarettes, but it is illegal to use other substances. So now you take these abused, traumatized people, you place them outside the law, you put them in jails, and you hound them all their lives, treating them like criminals and bad people and failures and rejects and less than human. And then we wonder how come they don't get better. So it's a self-perpetuating cycle of taking traumatized people and then re-traumatizing them and then hoping at the same time, why don't they listen? Why don't they get better already? Why don't they give it up? Well, they don't give it up because the more hurt they are, the more they need to escape. In other words, the addiction wasn't your problem. Your problem is that you had a lot of emotional pain you didn't know what to do with. So the addiction was really an attempt to solve a problem. So when you say, why do people use substances or why do they engage in addictions in general, it's because they have a problem they don't know what to do with. And if you really understand their addiction, you have to ask, well, what gave you so much emotional pain? And how come you didn't have the internal resources? This is not a judgment. It's simply an inquiry. How come you lacked at some point the internal resources to deal with that pain in a more creative, forward-looking way that would help you resolve the pain rather than to perpetuate it? So really what it was is that the addiction came along to help you solve a problem you had no other solutions for at the time. And that's the case for all addictions. So why do people use? Why do people engage in addictions? Because they have deep emotional problems they don't have the means to resolve on their own. That's why they use. The average medical student, until very recently, has never even heard the word trauma in their education. It doesn't show up. We don't talk about it. We don't talk about its impact on the brain, on the personality, on the emotional life of people, on its impact on people's physical health. It's not a word that we mention. We're trauma-phobic. As a fellow doctor said to me, the medical profession is trauma-phobic. Psychiatrists these days are trained mostly in this biological model of psychiatry where everything comes down to a biological brain disease. Here, let's give you a pill. The last thing most psychiatrists know how to talk about is actually emotional pain or its origins in human experience. You'd think they'd know how to do that, but they don't. They're not trained in it. It's not part of the predominant medical ideology. And, you know, as a physician, I can tell you, we like to think of medical as a science, and it has certainly great scientific achievements to its credit and great scientific insights to buttress its successes. But it's as much as ideology as a science. And ideology has certain hidden assumptions that are hidden from the people that believe in ideology. And so that if something is excluded by your ideology, you just won't see it. And so that you can be talking to somebody about your addiction, and the simple question, what did they do for you? And how come you're in so much emotional pain, doesn't occur to anybody, you know, trained in a classical manner. Now, this is true not just for physicians, it's true for a lot of psychologists as well, who are more interested in solving your problems and getting you to overcome the behavior than in asking, well, okay, where does the behavior come from? And what are you still carrying inside that's making you behave that way? And how can we help you resolve what's inside you? Not just how do we help you change your behavior, but how do we help you change? Now that's what healing is. And that happens inside a person. So it's never a question of anybody curing anybody else, but we can guide people to healing if we ask the right questions.
I love that summary. We can guide people to healing if we ask the right questions. Sometimes we don't even know what questions to ask, but we can always pray. And this is not an easy subject to solve, and we asked, is alcohol a solution to the problem? Well, for some people, unfortunately, it is, but we have offered other solutions tonight that we hope will be considered for those who are struggling with alcohol, and that you'll look at the other solutions so that you'll have better health in your mind, body, and your soul, because alcohol is definitely a spirit that damages all three of those, mind, body, and soul. So thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll share this with those who might be struggling. And we're going to say thank you tonight. Everybody have a great week, and we can tune in tomorrow. Only one mindfulness. Why?
We've come to the end of our show today, but you can hear every show in the archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/the-female-solution. You can also hear today's show on the Female Solution Facebook page. Go to www.facebook.com/the-female-solution. Leave your comments about today's show. You can always reach me on my website at www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com. Watch our TV shows, listen to our radio shows, order our books, and be sure to get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. On behalf of our team of radio hosts, I'd like to thank all of you who participated in today's discussion. And to our global family listening from all around the world, we say Thank you. To our family in China, Xiexie. India, Zanyaba. Japan, Arigato. Korea, Kamsahamnida. Russia, Spasiba. Germany, Danke. Poland, Jeong Kujung. France, Merci. Spain, Gracias. Italy, Grazie. Egypt, Shukran. Ghana, Madasi. Nigeria, Eshe. South Africa, Gibonga. Senegal, Jerez. Kenya, Asante. Israel, Toda. Pakistan, Shukriya. Afghanistan, Tashakur. Saudi Arabia, Shukran. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you. And may peace be upon you and the mercy of God and God's blessings.
Love you.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.